Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Smathers and Branson. What a great U.S. Open. What a great final round we had with Jon Rahm winning on his first Father's Day. You might not have gotten exactly what you wanted for Father's Day, so why don't you treat yourself to some of the best golf gear and accessories available, Smathers and Branson. You know, one of the big recommendations I have is if you want to, you know, get away from, you know, the standard head cover, maybe you got a stock head cover driver, maybe you got too many logos of clubs on your bag, you want to get rid of one of those. Smathers makes awesome leather head covers with the needlepoint, obviously. I actually gave one to my brother-in-law. He's a huge Grateful Dead fan, so I gave him a Dancing Bear one for his birthday recently, and he loved it. He was like, holy cow, this is really cool. It is an awesome gift. It's an awesome gift to give yourself outside of just, you know, the belts that they're made famous for. The accessories are really cool, including the performance hat. They have obviously all your, you know, professional teams, MLB, NFL, NHL, and then they also have universities. So you can get something that's, you know, personal touch for anyone with Smathers and Branson. And if you use the code FRIEDEGG, no spaces, all capitalized, at smathersandbranson.com, that's FRIEDEGG, no spaces, you will get 15% off your entire order plus free shipping. You know, that's belts. They've got new loafers, accessories, everything on the site. 15% off plus free shipping. So use the code FRIEDEGG and thank you for the support from Smathers and Branson. Today's episode is with, you know, he became a social media sensation. He was he made the cut at the PGA as a club pro, Brad Merrick. Brad and I have known each other for a long time. We played one round of junior golf together, and then we were, you know, we played a lot of golf about 6 years together, and it was really cool to see him resurface on the golf scene after numerous years of mini tour. Chip was really neat. So we talk about that PGA. We will have a recap podcast on the U.S. Open with Shane Bacon early next week. It'll probably be out on Monday of next week, so you'll have that, but to keep everything going, keep things moving, we got Brad today. He's got some incredible stories. This is really a riot of a podcast to record. And everybody can find Brad on social media, Brad Merrick Golf, and his website there. So without further ado, here is Brad Merrick.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie. I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
We call him Peppy Peter.
That is the nicest human on the planet. Like, that dude, I've never seen someone as happy in my life as he was when I made the cut on Friday. Like, genuinely happy.
It seemed like he was, like, really rooting for you.
Like, as much as some of the people that were wearing bucket hats outside the ropes. It was insane.
Yeah, you know, was it weird being really the only two guys wearing bucket hats and being in the same group? Do you think the PGA was trying to get cheeky with you?
It has to be, right? I mean, there's 156 guys. I mean, I'm not a math wizard, but it just seems pretty odd that the two of us end up paired together and both wearing a bucket hat. I feel like, yes, I feel like that was their plan, but who knows?
You had played with Peter in the Nebraska State Open years ago, too,
yes.
Right?
Yes, it was either 2010 or 2011. And, you know, I had been at mini tours for 3-4 years then, some success, but nothing crazy. And I think I was up by a couple shots going into the final round, and I played with Peter then, and he's kind of the same super nice guy that he is today. Just super chatty when he's on the golf course, and he went around, I think, bogey free and shot either 65 or 66 and ended up beating me by a few. He won. I finished second. And that wasn't his like springboard to success, but a few years later is when he, you know, Mondayed into a Corn Ferry, finished top 25, and I think won the next week. And he's basically been out on tour since then.
Having played many tours for a long time, you know, and obviously you saw a ton of guys, you played probably with tons of guys that made it, other guys that didn't. Was that when you played with Peter, did you notice anything that he did that made you think he would get there? Or was he, you know, do you think he was a guy that just, you know, kept developing, got hot at the right time? Like, you know, I think it, the whole mini tour getting there, things have to break right for you in certain aspects. And there's a lot of guys with great talent, but like, I'm just curious from your perspective as somebody that plays at a high level.
I will say this. I mean, if you're in the mini tours for years, you come across a lot of guys with pretty poor attitudes. And one thing that stood out about Peter could take anything and spin it positively. It's really unbelievable. And I think that comes in really handy in any level of golf, let alone the grind of mini tour and professional golf. So with that attitude, I'm not totally shocked that he made it. Obviously a really good player. He told me a funny story. I came up to him on the putting green just to introduce myself, because I know basically no one there other than just a couple of those guys that were part of the team at 20. So I introduced, you know, went up to him, you know, just kind of told him the story. And he's like, oh yeah, I remember you, obviously. And he was just like, you have no idea how close I was to quitting. He's like, if I don't win that, I mean, I was out of cash. And I think he won maybe $12,000 for that Nebraska Open. And he said that kept him going. That put him through Q school that fall. He didn't make it through Q school that year, but that kept him going the following year. And obviously, you know, he had success shortly thereafter.
I mean, that's the thing, right? It's like, I feel like so many guys are always looking for the next life raft when you're a mini tour player. Like, it's just like, you know, you're hoping something goes right a lot of times. And it is in your experience playing it, like, you know, are there things that you look back on being really, you know, you miss a lot? And are there what would you say you miss the most? And then what would you say is the thing that you don't miss the most?
Thing I miss the most is, I mean, it's kind of what you hear from a lot of athletes. It's just, I had a really good group of friends and guys that I would travel around with. Like when schedules would come out for state opens and mini tour things over the summer, we'd all kind of do a, you know, group FaceTime or a phone call in February or March and try to plot out what events we were going to go to together. Because if you're able to do it with a group, you got people to play practice rounds with, people to go to dinner with, it's kind of fun. And you have kind of a group of guys that you're all rooting for that week. You become really close friends. You're either sharing Airbnbs or hotels. So I miss that aspect. And you're just around the game a lot. You know, you're in these small towns. You really don't have anything else to do other than golf. So you're doing chipping contests, putting contests, gambling on the putting green, practice rounds, you know, trying to help each other out with, you know, with your swing. So that aspect of it, and just always trying to get better, is that part of it for me was really fun. I don't miss the bad hotels and, you know, random towns in the Southeast and the Dakotas like that. You know, eating the same takeout for 3 out of the 5 nights you're in the town. Yeah, that gets a little old.
What was the worst hotel that you ever stayed at? What's the worst lodging story?
Oh, man. There's a few. I mean, North Carolina, I think there was a hotel where the bathroom had a chain for the light in the bathroom. That was one of the lowest of the lows. I think it was like $35 a night, and it wasn't because I found a good deal on Priceline. had a car breakdown on me in the middle of Georgia once, and I was just literally stranded. Like, I had to take everything that was in there and like just put it in a box, ship it home, fly home, and then buy a new car when I got there. So,
were you going
to
a tournament? Did you have to WD too?
Thankfully, I was on my way home. Okay. So, but it was, there's always, always some stuff like that. There was one time I was on, we were at host housing at an event, and I'm allergic to cats. And I had no idea these people had cats prior to this. And I flew in there, so I don't have my own car, so I can't like go get my own hotel. So I was on an air mattress, right? And these cats like to nestle in with you. And so that happened the first night. So the second night, I put the air mattress on top of the pool table. And at 4 a.m, the cat tries to jump up on top of the air mattress, which is already on top of the pool table. And I like, it like wakes me up and I like panic and I hit the cat off and it falls to the floor and I felt really bad. Well, in that process, the cat had punctured the air mattress. So I wake up like 3 hours later and I'm in this air deflated air mattress where the ends are high, you know, my midsection is low. And that was probably the lowest of lows.
I mean, I gotta say, it's a bullshit host family. Like, if you're going to host a player, you got to have more than an air mattress.
Yeah, but I was not super happy. That took a little longer to get loosened up that next day, to say the least.
I worked for the startup, and they were super frugal. They would send me places for months, and they were super frugal with the Airbnbs. So, you know, there'd be three of us in a two-bedroom place, and we'd have to rotate who slept on the air mattress. So I had to sleep on this air mattress for a month once, and the place was like kind of like a – it was like two double wides put together in Santa Monica. Like, I mean, it was like – and you know, get cold there at night, and what, because there's no insulation on the floor, the cold air would hit the bottom of the air mattress and it would just deflate down.
I've been there. People that haven't slept on an air mattress don't understand. If you don't have good carpet underneath, that air mattress is 40 degrees by the middle of the night.
Yeah, and it's going down. You're going down to the ground.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's no way to live.
So you played just phenomenal golf, in particular the first round, you know. But rather than your phenomenal golf, you took the Twitter world by storm for your stretching routine. The world needs to know where it came from. How did you start doing it?
So, I'm going to preface all of this with, I feel like if I was Peter Malnati's size, this would not have gotten nearly the attention that it did. But unfortunately, I'm 6'6 with a bucket hat and had to be right in the middle of the range when all this was going on.
6'6 and 190 pounds.
Yes, soaking wet. Soaking wet. So it came from, I did a few years ago, I did some work with Jonathan Moore, who involved with Oklahoma State men's golf as their like kind of strength and fitness guru. So it's a functional kind of dynamic warm up that I'm sure I'm not doing. It's been a few years since I've worked with him, so I'm sure I'm not doing it 100% correct, but it's my hips and hamstrings get really tight. So just basically trying to loosen that up. And again, if I'm usually playing in front of either zero people or a handful of people in either, you know, Northern California PGA section events or, you know, a few mini tour events that I play. So I've certainly never seen it on film. Was caught by surprise when I finished on Friday and all of that stuff that happened during the round.
Did you get more texts about your good play or the stretching routine?
Thankfully, probably just by a little bit, the good play, but it's definitely close.
I have to say, we'll probably post something about this, but I have to say the stretching routine is incredible. After I saw it, I tried it out, and I loved it. You know, I said at the time that I wasn't going to incorporate it in my daily routine, but of course, you know, a couple weeks later, it's fallen completely by the wayside because I can't seem to stretch. It's the easiest thing to do is stretching every day, but I can't seem to get myself to do it, you know?
I do still have people, it seems like every other day, someone will randomly tag me in some Instagram story of them warming up, you know, doing the routine at some random golf course.
See, I think it's legitimately great. I used to do this thing with my, like, I looked ridiculous on the range, but, you know, I had a few buddies playing mid-am golf in Chicago that all swore by this. It was like, I'd do this, like, leg kick thing. And it really worked well, but that thing works even better. I think you're onto something, and I don't think that, you know, people should ridicule you for it because it really does work.
Some of the comments were pretty funny. I didn't go too deep into them because I knew they'd get really bad, but a few of them were pretty funny.
With the PGA, you were there super early. I think you. It seems like you made it part scouting for the golf course, part, you know, a little vacation with the wife and friends and family, right?
Yeah. So I knew, nice thing about, I mean, I run my own kind of golf academy instruction business out here. So I was able to kind of set my own schedule within reason. So got out there, I think 8 days before. Wife came with me for those first 3 days, she was working from the Ocean Course clubhouse. So there was nobody in there. So she basically had the whole clubhouse to herself other than some people setting up. So she was just working from that Ryder Cup room, which overlooks the ocean. So
what a delightful office.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad for her. And then she would, if she didn't have a meeting, she'd come carry the bag. We were doing kind of 9 holes a day, did 18 holes the first day I was there and realized just the size and scope of that property. And then that was the only time I played 18 holes prior to the first round. We would just go around and play 9 holes each day. Had all the pins from 2012. So we'd lay those down and just hit a bunch of short game shots to them, a lot of lag putts, just kind of plan out where you could and couldn't beat a certain hole.
Mm-hmm. You playing golf for a long time, obviously, I think like the way players practice has changed so much with the, you know, 9 hole routines versus 18. Do you remember when that like kind of shift happened? Because I feel like, you know, people our age, it was always 18, 18, 18. Have you been doing the 9 hole thing for a long time?
It depends on the course and just how much I know it. Like if I go to an event where I've played it 5 times, I feel like the need to play it, especially if the conditions are similar, like in terms of firmness, speed of the course, things like that, isn't necessarily that high. But if it's a place that I haven't seen, then I'm going to try to see it a bunch and I'd still probably play 18. But I feel like that shift has been, it's been relatively recent. I feel like it's really been like kind of last, I mean, Tiger was doing it, I feel like, even in his prime. But I feel like the masses haven't really started doing it until maybe 5-6 years ago where it was, man, it seemed like 90% of the guys out there were only playing 9.
Exactly. That's the thing is like, I feel like in the last, I would agree with you. It's like in the last 5 years, it used to be like everybody play 18 every day, you know, that was the conventional wisdom and the conventional wisdom's completely shifted. What were you like, you know, what were the things that you worked on outside of the short game shots and around the greens that when you saw the ocean course, you said, hey, these are things that I need to sharpen up before we get to Thursday, next Thursday.
Yeah, exactly. So I knew going in that, you know, most courses that I play in like mini tour state open section events, we're going to play it around 7,000. So it's, if you hit a decent drive, you're probably not going to have, other than a couple holes, more than 8 or 9 iron into a par 4. But Kiwa being so long, I knew that those longer clubs were going to be huge. So put a new 2, 3, and 4 iron into the bag that Ping built for me, those Ping crossovers, which throw them up in the air a little bit easier, and spent a lot of time on that because I knew that, you know, I mean, I think there were 4 par 4s over 500 yards or 3 over 500 yards. So I knew that was going to be key. So that was the time, you know, spent a lot of time in the range working on those shots, trying to work them both directions, either against the wind or ride the wind.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the wind, and obviously, you know, it was really blowing early in the week. Did you feel like you needed, it was a situation where you had to work the ball both ways at different times, or was it, you know, could you get away with just playing one shape?
For me myself, it was really hard because I don't hit it super high. Mm-hmm. So there were times that my only chance to stop it quick enough was I had to work it against the wind. For some of the higher hitters, I don't think it was as important. But you know, and I'm not super long either. So I've got a little bit longer club coming in and a little lower trajectory. So for me, you know, I was basically trying to work a lot of stuff off of the center of the greens and use a couple of the slopes there to try to funnel the ball closer to the hole. It's just such a, you know, from a strategy perspective, I mean, it's a course where you knew you're aiming at a lot of centers of greens. You're going to have a lot of lag putts for me. And, you know, so it focused a lot of time on lag putts as well, and trying to get that. And what people don't understand out there is the wind plays such a big role in the putting,
yeah,
both in the direction of it and then the speed. And if you had uphill into the wind, those putts were so slow. I mean, you had to hammer those things to get them there. And then if you were downwind, downhill, very, very fast.
That's the, you know, when wind gets tossed in, my putting is just goes complete shit. I can't handle another variable. It's just an utter disaster. And like that, the other thing is like the wind makes it so hard to hit it close, that it just forces you into it. And I think that's like generally, and I don't know if you agree, something that I kind of have thought more and more about is like how much better lag putting gets at every level of golf. Like every level you go up, the lag putting is maybe the easiest thing to see that's distinctly better.
Yes, I would not disagree with that at all, because I think the, you know, the lowest hanging fruit in, you know, most of the juniors that I teach, the first time I see them is speed control. And it's not, you know, what I think it's not just the speed control from 40, 50 feet. It's, you know, when you have this 12 footer that breaks 2 feet, I mean, if you don't hit that within reason of what you expect for speed, the putt has no chance of going in. So it's, you know, it's the speed control on those putts too. Cause it was, you know, if you didn't hit them the right speed this week, if you hit them too hard, the wind wasn't going to affect them. If you hit them too soft, the wind would just grab them at the end.
You've got your academy at Corica. Is it Corica? Is that how you pronounce it? Somebody got on me about how I pronounced it during the week, and I've got the.
It autocorrects on the iPhone to Corsica. Most people end up calling it Corsica. There's a lot of different pronunciations.
I think I called it Corica the right way. Corica. Yeah. So you got your academy at what? Do you think there's any ways that you've gotten better since you stopped playing competitively full time and you've been working with these, you know, high level juniors? Like, do you think teaching in a way has made you better at any aspect of the game of golf?
Yeah, I'm certainly more efficient with what I do in practice. Obviously, I don't have all day to practice anymore. So the time that I do get during the week is certainly kind of forced to be a little bit more efficient and a little smarter about what I do. And then with some of it, I mean, I do get to play maybe once a week. I'll go out and play 9 holes with some of the better juniors, which forces me to kind of lead by example. So I'll take part and I'll do some of that, do some short game contests with them. Cause I think it's really good for them, for me to be able to back up what I talk about with them in teaching. I think we do a lot of drills and kind of performance benchmarking to track progress over time. So doing short game contests and seeing, you know, well, this shot was really hard a couple months ago. Now we're better at this shot. So now what's the next area that we can improve and get better from there?
Yeah. How's your approach different to the teaching aspect of it than say when you were growing up? Because like, I think teaching changed quite a bit since we were juniors, and I'm interested to hear how
how you've kind of blended different experiences into a methodology?
I think that there's some things like, I think people underestimate how hard it is for anyone to actually make a swing change in a short period of time. And I think when I first started teaching, I think I thought that it was possible for really anyone to make a big change in a hurry. But I take a much more longer term approach that we're just going to try to blend, you know, wherever we are today, you know, let's try to get, you know, if we're working on a position, let's try to get this position better a month or two from now. And really understand that that aspect is going to take time. And there's things that I think can improve a little bit quicker, like decision-making on a golf course. Like with the juniors, we're kind of more holistically approaching how to get better. So can we be better with our mental process? Can we be better with our target selection? Can we be better with, you know, just how we go about practicing short game? Like, can we put more pressure on ourselves in practice with putting games and skills competitions, things like that, that are going to more closely resemble tournament golf? You're obviously never going to be able to truly replicate it, but rather than sitting there hitting the same 5-footer 10 times in a row, like, can we make this a more dynamic, changing environment, which is going to challenge you more?
I feel like when I always think back, it's like, if I could just have been less of an idiot as a junior, I would have been like 3 times better of a golfer. Like, it's so much of it is just like learning how to play golf.
Oh, you hit the nail on the head. I talk about this with juniors all the time. It's like, you're going to have, you know, you that was really well said. You're going to have these stretches of good and bad golf, but you can't let these bad stretches of golf kill your score to where your good golf doesn't matter. If you can get through your bad 7-hole stretch at 2 over, your good stretch can overcome that. You can make 4 birdies in the next 8 holes and all of a sudden you're 2 under. But if your bad stretch is 6 over through 7 holes, well, you're too far behind already. So it's, you know, it's the patience level of, you know, understanding, okay, I short-sighted myself here. Like, I don't need to try to hit this perfect flop shot to 2 feet. Let's get this up to 10 feet with a lower risk shot. If we make the putt, great. If not, like, let's move on and let's make some pars in the next couple.
And that's the thing. I think, like, with teaching, so much of it used to be just all technique based. Like, you get a lesson and you just go to the tee and you hit balls for an hour. Like, and it's like, that's kind of missing the whole point, because, like, the worst thing you could almost do when you hit a bad shot is start thinking about technique.
Yes, it does. I mean, it is kind of funny, and I feel like it's changing to some degree, but I still feel like, you know, we need to flip the percentage of time that's spent. Like, we need to be spending more time on the golf course, or at the very least simulate. I mean, now with TrackMan and things like that, you can at least play golf courses on the driving range to where you have to, you know, try to do other things besides just hit the same ball at the same target. But I feel like if we flip the percentage of time between standing on a tee, teaching a lesson, and taking a student on the golf course, I think both students and teachers would be better off for it.
What you talked earlier about having to get more efficient. Almost everybody that listens to this podcast works a 9-to-5 or more than a 9-to-5 and probably has hopes of playing slightly better golf, whether they care to admit it or not. What are a few things that you've done that, you know, going from full time, like, what are a few things that have worked really well in terms of, hey, I've downsized like the amount of time I have, like, that, you know, prioritizing different things, maybe, like, what are a few strategies that somebody could take home with them?
So, like, for me, I'll break it down into kind of zones in terms of iron play, and I'll do some basically training tests on TrackMan. So a wedge zone, kind of a 125 to 175 zone, and a 175 to 225 zone. I recognize that everybody is not going to have access to TrackMan, but
yeah.
So that's what I do there. But what I think you could do, what I think the easiest thing to do is kind of, if you can find 2 points, like 2 flags on a driving range that you know are, say, with a driver 25 yards apart, and just work in either 5 or 10 ball sets, trying to get, I'd say, 2/3 of those drivers in play, right inside that fairway. And I think if you can figure out a go-to shot off the tee that can help get one in play, I think that's really good. So I do a lot of stuff like that. Like on the range where I practice, there's these light poles at the end. And I basically use, you know, 2 light poles as my fairway. So you're trying to work the ball into those targets. And then but you can also do the same thing with, you know, mid irons too. So you find 2 targets that are 15 yards apart, right? And if you're hitting 6 irons in between those 2 targets, well, if you're missing the green, if your ball's staying inside those targets, you're either not choosing the right target or, you know, there's some other factor that's not letting that ball get on the green. Because once you get about 7 iron in your hands, if you're an amateur golfer, I mean, you better be aimed at pretty close to the center of the green. I mean, it's, you know, you'd be shocked at the conversations you hear, you know, at Kiowa. It's just, well, let's just work it off the center of the green, work it off the center of the green, work it off the center of the green. But I feel like a lot of amateurs feel like, oh, I got a 7 iron in the fairway. Like, I have to go right at the pin.
Yeah. That's what I say to people all the time is like, the better the golfer, the more conservative the golfer is. It's like, you know, like the best golfers in the world in a way are some of the most conservative golfers. Like they just, you know, the thing that they hate more than anything is making bogeys. So they, you know, to a certain extent, just absolutely terrified of bogeys.
Oh, 100%. And that's what I mean. And you're spot on there. Cause you look at high level golf. It's really not about making more birdies. It's about bogey avoidance and especially double bogey avoidance. It's just good golf is pretty boring. I mean, if you can just write pars down, it's a lot easier. And that was the thing at Kiowa is just, you're looking at this course and you're kind of thinking through the holes and you're just like, where are these birdies coming from? Like there was 2 par 5s that were downwind, 7 and 11. And man, if you didn't get at least one of those, you were struggling to see where other birdies were going to come from.
Yeah. Like 16 playing into the wind. How hard was that layup shot?
I hit driver off the deck 3 days there. If you're a bomber and could get it up top, it was slightly easier, but those fairways, the ball spun so much off the fairways that even trying to hit 3 wood off of that fairway into the wind, the ball was just going nowhere.
So that grass just made the ball spin more.
Yeah.
Which makes the wind more of a factor.
Yes. Yes. It was, you were seeing some numbers on TrackMan that were, your average, at least on my end, like it was at least 1,000 more RPMs with the average iron into the wind. Or not just into the wind, just off those fairways and then into the wind just amplifies that effect. So it's just going to balloon way more than it would off of a normal fairway.
Now for a quick word from our sponsor, Smathers and Branson. This is an awesome gift for anybody. Whether they're a serious golfer or not, like you can get somebody a belt is really neat that has nothing to do with golf. They've got all these music ones and, you know, obviously the team stuff. But the really neat thing, I think, is the life belt, which allows you to pick from numerous different logos. So you could get that, your favorite, you know, where you went to college, you could put it on the belt, but you could also have, you know, Rolling Stones, the tongue, you know, or Pink Floyd logo, or Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, you know, whatever fits your fancy, you can mix and match this. You know, you could have a dog on there since if you're a dog lover. I don't know, you know, anybody that doesn't like dogs, I don't trust anybody like that. But anyways, you can do the belt, the life belt on their website. It's really neat, really easy to do. And you get 15% off plus free shipping on the life belt if you use the promo code FRIEDEGG. That's 15% off plus shipping at smathersandbranson.com on the life belt and or anything else. Thanks to Smathers and Branson for the support. And now back to Brad Merrick.
How was the first round playing after that? Like where'd you play and how did it feel to go back to playing like a normal golf course?
I ended up going up to I was up in Spokane last weekend for, there was a mini tour event up in Spokane. And then I had US Open qualifying on Monday, and it was, fortunately it blew about 25 miles an hour. So that felt really familiar, but I think the golf course was like 6,600 yards long. So it was, you know, 1,000 yards shorter. So it was, yeah, it was certainly, I joked with some of my friends, like I went to Whole Foods on the Tuesday after the PGA, and I like got coffee, and no one cheered for me when I got the coffee. So that was kind of a rude adjustment.
That's the way I always felt after you played like a big, the day you go back to playing like just regular setup golf after big tournament, it's like, oh, thank God I'm back to this.
It felt nice to play golf where you could actually make birdies. Kiowa was so hard. Especially those first 2 days when the wind was whipping, it was brutal.
I got a question for you. So how many times have you played like US Open qualifying?
Gazillion? Too many to count. Yeah, probably 20 years now. I probably started doing it junior or senior year of high school, and maybe there was a year in there I missed because I had something else, but yeah, there's certainly not more than 1 or 2 years that I missed it.
You missed out by a couple. Seems like you were in it in Washington, but then you see a guy like Andy Pope. You grew up playing with Andy Pope. You probably know him pretty well. He's qualified 5 of the last 6 years. Do you think there's something like what makes somebody great at qualifying? You know,
it is remarkable. I mean, it's unbelievable what he's done. I didn't know it was five of the last. I knew it was a lot, but I didn't know it was 5 of the last 6. That's incredible. And there's guys, you see like Brian Stewart, who I think has gotten
Springfield
through.
Every year.
Yes. Hardy's the same way. And Hardy, I think, was inside the number until the last couple holes this year. There's certainly something. I mean, and I feel like I never play well there. So I would love to know. I would love to know what his approach is, but there are certain guys that I don't know. A lot of these are held at the same course a lot. But even still, it's incredible because the talent that's in those qualifiers is pretty high. And to, you know, it's not a high number of spots. I mean, it's just 80 guys for 4 spots. I think at those, you know, the one that Andy was at this year.
Mm-hmm. Do you think junior golf, like how much better is junior? You're obviously a very good junior player. You played at Indiana. Like, how much better is junior golf now than when we even played it?
I think it's deeper than it used to be. I think it's kind of similar to what's going on, like at a professional level. Like it seems like it's the high end golf is probably definitely a little bit better. But I mean, there were studs even when we were playing that were just dominating junior golf. But I feel like the above average player is better at junior golf than when, say, we were playing junior golf. I think the strategy has gotten a little bit better overall. Like I don't see the same, you know, kind of silly mistakes. There are some, but I feel like the silly mistakes are a little bit less. Yeah, that's what I would say.
Yeah. I mean, when I was a freshman, I was just hoping to shoot like 42. And now you see these kids like shooting like 65 as 14-year-olds. I'm like, what? It's a different world.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Yeah, it is kind of wild.
You played a lot of different sports too growing up. Are you seeing most kids specialize early at a younger age, or is it, you know, pretty much across the board? And do you think specialization at a young age is helpful, or do you think like other stuff is good? You know, other sports are good.
I think other stuff is really good. I think you do see, I certainly see a lot more earlier specialization, and it's been tough because these kids don't have, you know, for the last year and a half, they haven't been in school. So they don't have any kind of PE class or anything like that. So I just don't see with the people that don't early specialize, you generally see a better developed athlete. For the kids that are specializing early, if there's no other athletic outlet, I just kind of on average, I feel like those kids have less speed, they're less dynamic, and it's a little bit harder for them to make some of the changes and ramp up the speed to where it needs to be versus the kids that are playing, you know, basketball, volleyball, soccer, things like that.
Yeah, I think that's spot on, because when I had the most speed in my life, I was playing the most pickup basketball in my life. And it was about the quick twitch and the explosion that you get from like running and jumping all the time. And then it translated, like, I just, like, you know, after playing, you know, 3 day a week pickup hoops and leagues and stuff over an entire winter, the next year I came back, I was like 20 yards longer just doing it for no, you know. And I think that's something I think with juniors, it's kind of because those other sports help with other things.
I had one of my best juniors who's having a really good summer, won a big amateur tournament around here, then followed it up with an AJGA win, and finished second in another AJGA. He's had a rock star summer. And this was two winters ago, he was swinging at about 97 miles an hour, and he's in his sophomore year of high school, goes and plays basketball for his high school team, comes back, and obviously he grows a little bit, gets a little bit stronger, but, you know, I'd see him like, you know, once a week in there, just kind of making sure that things were not falling too far out of line. And then he got back into golf, you know, full time, you know, once the basketball season ended, and he's swinging at 110 miles an hour, and he really didn't play golf, but a couple times a week. And it's just from, you know, he was in the gym with basketball, but he was, you know, playing 5-6 days a week. And it was unbelievable. It was the biggest jump I've ever seen in that short of time.
That's, I think, just in general with golf, like people fall in the habit of, you know, thinking if you want to be great at golf, you have to devote everything to golf. But like so many times I've found over the course of my life, like getting away from it almost helps me more than being in it.
100%. And if you look at some of these top guys, I mean, you put, you know, Dustin, you put Brooks, you put those guys on a basketball court. I mean, that's going to be a killer pickup basketball team. I mean, these guys would be good at any sport that has hand-eye coordination and athleticism involved. I think that sometimes that gets a little lost, is that you think that, oh, I need to sit there and just hit, you know, hit these flop shots or hit these four footers repetitively. And like, there's cross training matters too, in my opinion. It's not just all about golf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I don't think we've gotten to a point where at any certainty you could say that you're losing by not specializing right off the bat, because if you look at the top players in the world, a lot of them played different sports. Like obviously Tiger's the case in point to specialization, but then, you know, you go down the list, like DJ played a lot of different sports, Justin Thomas probably a specialization guy, you know, I think John Rahm played some other sports, but then, you know, there are guys like with Brooks, like Brooks wanted to be a baseball player. He hates golf, right? You know?
Right.
And Rory famously broke his ankle playing soccer. It's just, you know, I think it gets lost. Like you think you have to work so hard. I think you're a case in point. I'm guessing that you probably feel in many ways you're better than you were when you decided to hang him up now.
Oh, 100%. I mean, honestly, I think one of my best mini tour seasons was 2018. I think I won twice, finished second twice, and I was teaching full time. I would just, you know, I was just getting started, so I would still go out and play some mini tour events to make some extra cash. And yeah, it was kind of funny. I mean, it was, you know, I was certainly practicing 40% of what I used to practice, and the results were better.
Hey, how do you even go about building up a book of business as a teaching pro?
A lot of it's word of mouth. You know, I was fortunate. When I first started, I had a partner with what I was trying to do with the academy, and he had a few higher level guys that he threw my way. And you know, those guys start having success, and the best, especially in junior golf, the absolute best marketing is going to be word of mouth. And so you have a few people that start having success, and then, you know, these kids can't drive themselves when they're early on in their junior golf days. So the parents are following them around the golf course, and inevitably the parents get to talk, oh, who are you working with? And it's just referrals. I mean, I've had, you know, probably one or two students that have got me probably 2/3 of my, you know, higher end junior students, like in terms of, you know, best players.
Did you get a lot of calls after the PGA?
Yes. A lot of calls, a lot of emails, a lot of questions about the bucket hat and where they could get that.
What about calls for client, like new juniors?
A lot of calls, emails through my website, things like that. So it's been, that has been incredible. So trying to, you know, the last couple of weeks has been, you know, trying to fit these new people in, into the schedule and see if there's ways that I can help.
See, that's why like playing matters, right? You know, playing the PGA, like the club pro stuff matters, because it's like, it's probably your best, you know, make it, you got to make the cut every year. It's the best advertising you can get.
Yeah. I didn't really realize how much coverage there was until I kind of got back and sifted through all these messages and, you know, realized how much I was on TV and just talked to some friends that were watching. Man, you were on TV a lot. So it's been, yeah, it's a good problem to have. Let's put it that way.
How many Uber rides did you give in your career? How long did you Uber for?
The first winter I started dating my now wife, like I didn't go down to Florida like I usually did. So I would.
Was it because you met her?
Pretty much, yeah. Like I think I was planning on going down to Florida, and then I went to Florida, but it was just for a short amount of time, so I needed something to do, and this was like when Uber was first starting, when I would typically Uber from like 6 a.m. till, you know, rush hour was over, and then I'd go to the gym, and then I'd go, you know, hit some golf balls inside, and that was kind of my day. It was interesting, let's put it that way.
Was I the only person that recognized you?
I think so. Yeah. I did it for probably like 6-7 months, like that winter, and then just in the spring as I was leading up to playing that summer. But yeah, maybe one other. But yeah, I think you might have been it though.
That was wild. It was funny, like, because I hadn't thought of that until you were playing, and I was like, you know what? Because I was like thinking about just like things that I remember, I was like, oh, I think he drove Uber. Like the whole memory. How does it work? So you make the cut. Does that get you exempt into the Club Pro Championship? Like, how does it all work with that? I don't know enough. Are you in the PGA Cup, one of the best events in golf? Like, what? How does that all work? Like, what is getting, making the cut outside of a, you know, probably one of the biggest paychecks of your life, in terms of a pro golf career, what else does it get you?
So it gets me out of pre-qualifying and first stage of Q school for this year for Korn Ferry.
Are you going to do that?
So yeah, if going straight to second stage, you kind of have to, in my opinion, if you can go right to there. So I'll definitely do that.
When was the last time that you'd done Q school?
Q school. I went to Europe in like 2015. I went to Europe in 2015, had some like pretty bad conditional status on like the challenge tour that I never really took advantage of. But yeah, that's the last time I've been to any Q school. So that'll be good. It gets me exempt into the PGA Professional Championship for the next 2 years. So hopefully give me a good opportunity to play, hopefully in some more PGA championships. And then, it gets me out of the pre-qualifying portion of Monday qualifiers for the PGA Tour for the rest of the year. So it can go right to the Monday qualifiers.
Are you going to do any of those?
Yeah. So I'll go, I think the first one I'm going to do is up in Minnesota in July. I'll do the Barracuda, which is by us, in August. The event at Silverado, I don't know the sponsor anymore, the one that used to be Safeway's here. And so I'll probably go to 6 or 7, I'd say, over the course of 2021.
trying to get into the Ben Cook zone here. You know, you're going to make me eat all my words here.
Well, if you can go straight to the Mondays, it's easy because you can fly out on Sunday and then fly back on Monday if you miss. If you have to do those pre-qualifiers, you're essentially at that site for 6-7 days.
Yeah, that whole model, if you can't, it's like a hopeless model if you are trying to go to pre-qualifiers and then Mondays. It's like two ridiculous things, you know, then a lot of days on site. What would you do? Say you got Korn Ferry status, like, what do you do? Like,
I really like what I do. I don't think that I would stop. I mean, one, even if you get status with the Korn Ferry, I mean, there's really not that many really good cards at Q School. I mean, you're really, unless you get in that top 40 at the finals, you're fighting to get in events. So, I mean, a lot would depend on how good the status would be. But, you know, then I'd have to figure out a way. If that happened, I'd probably have to figure out a way, bring in somebody else to help me teach, so that I could focus a little bit more on my game. But I don't know. I've just kind of approached, you know, all, like, once I started teaching, I just wanted to see, you know, keep practicing on my end and just see if I could keep getting better. There's obviously less pressure on my game now because it's not the primary source of income, but I just like the challenge of getting better and, you know, spending some time, you know, trying to get better with some of the longer clubs that has typically been, you know, my weakness, and, you know, see how good I can get.
Yeah, and it gave you a reason to get a TrackMan, right? When you're a mini tour pro, you can't afford one. But when you're a teaching pro, you have to have one.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, the conversation went a lot easier with my wife when I was telling her that we needed this, you know, this TrackMan when I was actually teaching as opposed to playing. So that was, for sure, that was nice.
Do you think low club pro should be exempt the next year to the PGA?
I don't. Maybe if it comes with making the cut, maybe
you have to make the cut.
It's a really good question. I hadn't thought of that.
It's something I was thinking about. I almost put it in a column, but you should. If you're low club pro, it's such a neat part of the championship. Like, you should be back. Like, we get to know the low club pro. We get to know the club pros that make the cut. And then, like, the next year rolls around and you don't know if they're going to be in it.
Right. That is a good point. Because it is interesting that, you know, I mean, Ben and I still have to go play really well at, you know, the PGA Professional Championship just to get back to the PGA. And it's, yeah, that is an interesting point. It wouldn't be a bad idea.
Well, Ben's not a low club pro. He's now... back on, he's got PGA tours claiming him as their own low club pro. You know, this is real. I've launched a full investigation. The findings are he was disqualified as a club pro. He had a great finish as a Latin American qualifier.
Man, if you're doing that with Ben, what are you doing with Omar?
Omar might have a whole podcast, you know, dedicated to him. I advocate that he should have to wear a different uniform based off of what status he's playing off of, you know, because some weeks he's in as a PGA member and then other weeks he's in as a PGA Tour member. And it's just, you know, I've got an associate. I'm not going to name my source. He's a retired PGA professional living down in the village down there, the PGA village, you know, where the three courses are.
Oh yeah.
He was telling me, he was like, oh, I was like, what have you been doing? He's like, well, you know, been playing golf, been watching golf. They have all these like section events down here. And he was like, I was like, oh, you know, those ones that Omar cleans up on. And he's like, oh yeah. You know, all us retired guys, we can't stand Omar. And he told me a story. Some guy beat him in a playoff, and there was like 70 old retired club bros just like, we're going nuts when the other guy won. Like, they're just cheering like crazy. They were like, he was like, we were just so happy that kid beat him.
I will not name names either, but when we finished up in Florida, so we had to do media stuff for the PGA Championship, and the TVs were on because it was obvious, you know, who was going to be inside the cut, and the last few holes were going on, and it was very eye-opening, some things that were being said while the television coverage is on. I'll just say that.
I think he played 400 events or 500 events on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, he's made $3.5 million. I mean, he's played 300 plus rounds just at those golf courses in Florida alone that tournament was on.
I feel the same way with like mid-am golf. Like, you know, I play the mid-am and I'm hitting balls next to Jess Daly, and I'm like, we aren't the same person here. Like I was 23 and went and worked in an office. Like you were on the PGA Tour.
Some of that stuff, especially with the mid-am, is incredible just to see the disparity in the backgrounds of some of these guys. I mean, they're like the reinstated amateurs that just came off an 8-year, you know, professional career are playing in the mid-am.
Well, I saw John Peterson's going to get his mid-am. He's going to have mid-am status. And like,
Danny, he's waffled like 18 times on that. He's gone from a business guy to Monday qualifiers to I'm getting my amateur status back.
I saw that they said it would take 2 years. I mean, you're talking about a guy. He made like $4 million.
Yeah, but the guy almost won the U.S. Open, and you're going to be going up against him in the mid-am.
My dreams of that are long gone until this part phase of my life is over. So I don't have to worry about that. That's for other people I have to worry about at this point. But yeah, it's a wild thing. I think the question is like, where does Omar go? Like, where do these guys go? There needs to be some purgatory that they're put into. Like, you know, they shouldn't go down and beat up on club pros. I think that's like you have to like have a full profession. Like Omar does not work.
No, I don't know. I don't understand why the loophole was created to begin with. Like, I don't really understand why. And I don't know much about it, but it just seems, I don't know. I just don't know why that option was ever existed in the first place. I mean, Omar followed all the rules. I don't know why the rules were there.
I was thinking, you know, a funny bit if you ever did it would be like go to where Omar says he's a pro and then just sit there and ask members or local players that come in and be like, hey, you ever seen this guy around? Like, you ever take a lesson from Omar? You see him fold? you ever see him folding shirts in a pro shop? Working the register?
I love it.
So where are we gonna see you next? We're gonna see you at the Club Pro Championship. Maybe we'll see you Monday, you know, qualifying school's not on TV. Maybe we'll see you Monday in something.
Yeah, that's the hope. Nothing. I mean, nothing as cool as, you know, being on TV that much at the PGA Championship. We've got our like Northern California PGA Section Championship coming up in July. Winner of that gets into the event that's up in Napa.
Ah, that's a big one. There's got to be a lot of good players in Northern California.
Yeah. And one of the perks of our section is that we have three exemptions into tour events based on, you know, who wins our match play, who wins our stroke play, and who wins player of the year. So that's good. And just trying to get ready for, you know, stuff in the fall.
I imagine when you moved to California, that made playing actually like kind of harder full time, right?
The travel aspect of it. Yeah, because there aren't really, you know, most of the mini tours are kind of in the south, southeast, and the Midwest over the summer. So traveling out of here became a little bit harder. You're always flying, you know, back east somewhere to play in something.
And then your website for where people can find you. What is it? BradMerrickGolf.com?
Yeah, and Marek is M-A-R-E-K, and then on Instagram, at Brad Marek Golf. So pretty easy.
Hey, one last question. Is it really just the same lesson every time? Because I think that, like, I've never gotten a different lesson. It's just the same. I always am doing the same things.
I think what separates really good teachers from teachers that aren't as good is that I think the really good teachers have a lot of different ways to say the same thing.
Well, that's the guy that I've gone to, he says it differently every time. But then when I think about it, it's the same thing.
Yeah. And I think, you know, some of the things is like understanding, like, can you find a way to essentially trick your student into the right position? Like, if it's physically hard for them to achieve, can you give them a drill or can you do something that's going to get them there where they might not have been able to get to by just consciously trying to think about it?
I imagine that's so frustrating because you're trying to explain something and people just don't understand it. And then you could say it's something just like just a little bit different. And then they're like, oh.
Yeah. At the end of the day, it's the student that has to come up with it on their own, essentially. You're just, as a teacher, you're just trying to lead them to the right thought that resonates with them, in my opinion.
I agree with that.
You're just trying to, you know, basically guide them. You know where you want them to get, but you're just trying to guide them to where, you know, they understand the solution and can kind of feel it and describe it and kind of own it on their own.
One last thing. What's your pet peeve for a student? What's the thing that just grinds your gears?
Oh, when the student knows exactly. When the student, or in my case with the juniors, when the parent knows, you know, exactly what their kid needs to do and what the kid is doing wrong and what the fix is.
And tells you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's like, okay, so why are you here? Like, why? I mean, just move down a few stalls and you guys can work on it. And I can hit some wedges here myself. Yeah, that's always my favorite. Or the, you know, well, he does X, Y, and Z, so he just needs to do this. Okay, great. Like, yeah, that's fine. Go ahead.
That happens to me sometimes too. Similar is like people will tell me stuff that they clearly read from one of my articles, and I'm like, yeah, I wrote about that. That was my article.
And you missed a couple of those stats in there. You're not exact. You didn't remember those perfectly there.
All right, Brad, it's been awesome talking to you. Hopefully we'll see you again at Southern Hills.
That would be a good plan. I would like that.
Yeah, and good luck. I'm sure you're in the PGA Cup. You got to be.
I don't know. I have any idea on the point.
You got to research that. Get it, yeah. In that PGA Cup.
Is that this year? Is that next year?
I don't know.
Great
event.
I love it. Good catching up. Enjoyed it.
All right. Later.
Thank you for listening to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by Meg Atkins. Just as a quick reminder, we've got some great events this summer and into the fall. We just released a couple new events at White Bear Yacht Club, the Regatta, as well as Pine Hills, an incredible golf course up in Sheboygan. That's the day after the Ryder Cup. So we're going to do a big match play match up there. It's only an hour from Milwaukee. And really, I think it's probably one of the best courses I've ever seen that nobody has ever talked about. So White Bear is obviously, you know, a top 100 golf course, one of the best golf courses in Minneapolis. That's going to be an awesome event. We have that, as well as we have some spots still at Davenport at the end of July. Davenport is amazing, amazing Allison golf course, the best Allison golf course that I've seen. And it's only about 2.5 hours from the city of Chicago. So come out to an event. They're really fun. Everybody has a good time. It's a, you know, friendly competition with some great prizes and great people. So thanks for listening to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. We will be back next week.